Please be seated. Well, the first time we visited our son and daughter-in-law in Nova Scotia, it's while Kelly was doing her residency, we pulled into their driveway in our rental car at around 7 a.m. in the morning after a red eye. They still did those back then. I don't know if they still do them now. It's a great way to get to the other side of the country. But as we stepped out of the car in our sleep-deprived state, we were greeted by their very enthusiastic golden retriever named Nutka. She proceeded to leap upon me with such enthusiasm and force that I was literally knocked to the ground. And over the next few days, as I observed and physically experienced her enthusiasm and behavior, I noticed something kind of strange. She would forage and dig, and her specialty and favorite, chase squirrels. But just as the fear of God entered the squirrel, she would screech to a halt at the very edge of Nick and Kelly's wooded property, forlornly looking across what looked like an invisible divide to me after the squirrel as it scampered away. I found out that when she was a puppy, they had placed sensors at the boundaries, fitted her with one of those collars that recognize said sensors, and that gave her a bit of a shock as she touched this invisible boundary. But after a time, they were able to turn the system off, take the collar off, and she was properly conditioned to the boundaries that were safe for her. Now, this wall was as real in her mind, as insurmountable as a brick wall, even though the squirrel could kind of magically go through it, such is the canine brain. Now, Nick and Kelly's retriever could imagine walls, but humans, of course, go a step further. It's us and the beavers. We build them. From this fake wall, or faux wall, in this story, to the Great Wall of China, which, as lore has it, is the only human-made object that can be seen from space. I don't know if that's true or not, but such is the lore. And we build all of these walls and fences for safety, for comfort, to keep order, as well as for beauty. We use the language of walls in our relationships as well, when we talk about establishing boundaries, boundaries that allow us to maintain our personal identity in the midst of work, in a relationship, or in other types of friendship and acquaintance relationships. One of the two characters in Robert Frost's poem Mending Wall summarizes much human thinking on why we build them by saying, good fences make... Right. It's become the cliche. It's become the common wisdom. Good fences make good neighbors. So walls make sense. End of story. Well, no, it's not the end of the story. Because the human propensity to proliferate what is good in one context to all contexts means that walls, boundaries, fences, whatever we call them, have become definitional, not only of human history, think the history of empires, think the history of any conflict, think the present day situation in the Holy Land where a wall runs between the Palestinians and the Jewish state. They become definitional of all of that, but also definitional of our fundamental dysfunction as a species. The devastating political divisions at present simply highlight a reality that has always been there. Economic walls between the rich and poor. Conceptions of God that create divisions, not only across religions, but within a religion, as we see with Christianity. We are better, it seems, at seeing difference than similarity, better at imagining a foe than imagining someone who might be a friend, and so easier to separate ourselves from others. Whether this happens because of evolutionary pressure or epigenetics, we nurse old grudges and ancient hatreds, and they become the binaries of good, bad, true, false, with quite alarming speed and ease, creating this myriad of walls and divisions that have literally written human history, and for each of us in this room, had a large part in shaping our lives. So into this predicament, into this reality, we drop our first reading from the letter to the Ephesians, a letter that is as dense as it is profound. In the year 2012, the preeminent progressive Christian magazine, The Christian Century, held a contest. It asked well-known theologians and laypeople and pastors to put the Christian message in 7 words. The Princeton theologian, Ellen Chari, a converted Jew, submitted her entry with these words: "The wall of hostility has come down. The wall of hostility has come down." And she was, of course, drawing from what we read today, drawing actually from her own experience. Christ has broken down the dividing wall that he might create in himself one new humanity in the place of two, thus making peace, and might reconcile both groups, that is, Jews and Gentiles, so the rest of humanity, to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. So he came and proclaimed peace to you Gentiles who were far off, and peace to those who were near, Jews. For through him both of us have access in one spirit to the Father. Now it's common to think that the Christian message could be summarized quite differently than how Chari did it. That's something about saving, Christ saving us. And from the human side, about us having faith in Christ that we might be saved. Something along those lines. And indeed, there's nothing wrong with that kind of language. Paul, just before the text we looked at today, says pretty much that. But if we leave it there, and notice Paul doesn't, it becomes a kind of Rorschach test. You can see in words like save and faith almost anything you want. And what we see in our world is different Christian cultures reading into these words different meanings. Meanings that create their own sets of walls and binaries. Whether it's the Patriarch of Moscow supporting Putin and calling on all the Russian Orthodox to do the same, making Christianity, by doing that, a mere subset of Russian nationalism. Whether it's parts of the United States or Canada identifying certain political movements and parties with Jesus Christ. Or whether it's faith identifying with one particular morality which includes some people who behave in certain ways and have certain beliefs and excludes people who don't. What's common to all of that is that faith and salvation is being used to define something that is actually quite opposite of what Paul is talking about here. And so what is brilliant about Chari's summary, and brilliant, of course, from Paul, is that they get the thing right way round. It's the goal. It's the end, the telos, the fulfillment that defines what faith and saving mean. Christ takes down the wall of hostility through the cross, and those who follow him define what it means to be saved and to have faith by how they too have now been included, and by how they are open to challenging their own binaries wrought in ignorance and fear, and participate with Christ in the work of this new unified humanity. What we are saved for and towards is becoming people who recognize walls of hostility. We have the capacity, unlike Nootka, the golden retriever, to do so with God's help, and to see before us the blueprint that Christ has fashioned in his suffering, what he drew in his pain, a blueprint that calls for building bridges, not digging moats. Now, if we're not to misunderstand what I've just said to you, which I think is something close to what we mean by the gospel, this new humanity, we do not see its goal to make everyone the same, which has been the great misunderstanding of Christendom, especially in many of its missionary expressions, especially in many of its colonizing tendencies. So this gospel is not a European thing. It's not a North American thing, but a global reality in which differences of culture and language and perspective can flourish. And it's not sameness of ideas or sameness of viewpoint or how we worship that ties it all together. But as Paul says, it's God's peace, the dwelling of God, God's very self, that ties it all together. Indeed, peace, the most repeated word in our text today, is the synonym in this passage for the dwelling of God, the God who in Christ has absorbed our hostility on the cross. So this looks like many things, of course, lived out by you and me. But today I just want to highlight what is kind of countercultural for our day and age. When we do the difficult work of communicating, that is listening deeply, when we dare in humility to speak the truth, not to control others, but that it might come out, if you will, in dialogue. When we do this in a way that doesn't prejudge, based on what we think we know about the person we're talking to, who we may think believes things very wrongly. Let's take that further. If we can sacrifice for people who say something that might be interpreted as hateful, is that not what Jesus did? When I learn to move from abstractions and binaries, things like men are from Mars and women are from Venus, or any of the divisions that basically define political correctness, the political correctness wars in our culture, and when I can kind of wade through that and just simply see a human being made in God's image before me, then I, and maybe we, all of us, in a small way, participate in what Christ has done. Then we dare hope that all the noise and fury around us, all the hostile shouting maybe inside of us about this and that, is not yet the end. The other character in Frost's Mending Wall says this to the one who said, "Good fences make good neighbors." He says this, Spring is the mischief in me. And I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do walls make good neighbors? Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. Of course, this is the greatest project the world could ever imagine. A new humanity? Seriously? Of course, it's the way to live that will challenge us the most. It's the way that has challenged God the most. Right? It is the way to the most profound inner transformation. Of course it is. But why else do we revere the cross?